Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do our 24/7 digital ties affect our real relationships, and do they help or hurt our professional productivity? While our hyper-connected world makes it easier than ever to keep up with work, friends, and media, constant contact can also be a major impediment to completing our to-do list, let alone engaging in meaningful thought and conversation. And while we think of this as an unprecedented element of human experience, journalist William Powers has discovered that great minds have grappled with the stresses of changing technology for thousands of years. So in a remarkably different kind of analysis of connection overload, Powers decided to look to the past for wisdom. His new book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
You write here about the modern assumption that being connected is inherently good and being disconnected is bad. Why do we believe that?
I think we believe that because humans are really built or wired to connect. You know, it's how we survive. It's how we've built up this wonderful civilization of ours. It's how we get by in life. You know, we need to connect to others, really, to survive and reproduce and do all those good things we do. So there is a kind of a bias in us toward connectedness, which I think is healthy and good. And when a new technology comes along that helps us do that, we embrace it, which is what we've done in the last couple decades with digital.
You have in the book here a fantastic quote from Marshall McLuhan, who wrote, "Men at once become fascinated by any extension of themselves in any material other than themselves."
Yes.
Is this all rooted in our narcissism?
Yeah, he actually calls that the narcissist trance. And I think it's not narcissism because I don't think it's unhealthy. You know, I think of narcissism as a disorder. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that we do because we're trying to figure out who we are. You know, we see a reflection of ourselves in a screen or in any device. You know, we see other human beings who remind us of ourselves. And it makes us feel good. It makes us understand a little better why we're here and who we are. So although McLuhan had a little bit of a cynical take on it, I have sort of more of a "this is what we're made of" take.
I love the way that you start the book, which is by visualizing our technology as putting everybody who is online at any one time into a big giant room together. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I call it the digital room. And the reason I opened with a kind of allegory, a fictional allegory, is that I wanted to help people to step back from this new way of life that we're so immersed in, it's hard to get perspective on it. So I basically say to the reader, imagine you've moved to a room, a gigantic room, with a billion other people. And those people can come over to you and tap you on the shoulder anytime they want, share some piece of information, ask you a question. And this happens day and night in the room. All day long, people are tapping each other. And even at night when you're asleep, you have your own personal zone where you live, but the walls are permeable. And people can come through and leave you messages that are waiting for you in the morning instead of tapping you. And essentially, you know, let's face it, that's how we're living. The protagonist of my little story starts to have a fantasy about getting out of the room, spending a little time in a different space. And he has trouble finding a way out. He can't find anyone who can give him directions. And that's sort of what I tried to discover in the book, is help people find escapes, ways of organizing their lives so they do have a little bit of time away from these wonderful devices, because I think we need some gaps in our lives where we're a little bit less connected.
Well, and the other thing I liked about that example, that allegory, was that, you know, of course we all worry that we're going to miss something important, but there are a lot of communications that include things like, "I am now eating a cheeseburger," things that we don't need to know about our friends.
Yeah, I used that example. Someone in the room says, "I'm now eating a cheeseburger," and holds it up for you to see. You know, that happens to me on Facebook all the time. You know, people are sharing more than I think really needs to be shared to help me in my life, extraneous. I think it is part of the enthusiasm of the new device. We're so thrilled when these things come along. We want to try them. You know, Twitter is arguably the latest example, and Twitter's great fun. You know, I've tweeted, and I'm tweeting now about my book. I do one tweet a day. That's my rule. But if you do it too much, if you're tweeting every 3 minutes, as some people seem to do, what are you getting out of it? You know, the costs begin to exceed the benefits, I think.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Twitter. I've started Twittering once a day, tweeting, I should say. Mm-hmm. I got to get the verbs correct here. The New York Times maybe would support me. But I've started doing this once a day about the show. And I've wondered sometimes if anybody's really reading these or if we're all just sort of spewing forth information and assuming that someone is reading it?
You know, I think there's a pretty big spew element, but I also would say that as with any digital technology, a funny thing happens where you throw it out into the void, and a few people always pop up who noticed it, people you've never met before. Sometimes it turns into a relationship. I mean, I had somebody tweet about my book the other day, and he had 17,000 followers. And all of a sudden, I started hearing from those followers. You know, they started tweeting, and they were interested. And things develop, and that's the wonderful upside of these devices, is you do meet people and have meaningful exchanges and move forward in life through that. The question is, what happens if all you're doing all day is staring into some kind of a screen? That's where trouble begins, and that's what I try and address in the book.
Yeah, so it's either this wonderful collaborative process, or it is, as you describe it, sort of a search for external validation.
Yeah, people are looking for confirmation. You know, it's nice to post comments and then check back and see who commented on your comments. It's nice to see people in your inbox. You feel like, I matter, I'm alive. All of that is great. But I think we've been following this philosophy, you know, that you referred to earlier that I call digital maximalism. The more connected you are, the better. And I just don't think in the end it's healthy. You know, there is more to life than the screen, and there's a lot to be learned and gained from the space we've been living in since the beginning of time, the three-dimensional world. And I'm trying to show people that and kind of bring a little balance back into life.
So let's talk a little bit about how our ancestors experienced similar crises. Instead of trying to predict the future here, you decided to look for parallels in history, which, you know, at first glance would seem to be a really difficult thing to do. But talk about Plato and the sort of new technological advance that had him concerned.
Yes. So Plato, you know, the reason I went backwards is that I wasn't finding any helpful practical advice in today's landscape. And it occurred to me, you know, people have been through technological shifts before. Let me go back. So I thought I might just go back to the 19th century, but then I discovered that these shifts are much older, and Plato is the first one I look at. Ancient Greece, 5th century B.C. Greece has been an oral society, conversation-based, for hundreds and hundreds of years. Suddenly the alphabet has appeared for the first time, written language. And believe it or not, it was really controversial. There were people who were enthusiastic about it and hopeful, you know, sort of the early adopters, if you will. And there were people who were really worried about it, including Plato's teacher and hero, Socrates. Socrates said, this alphabet stuff is going to destroy our minds. And it's amazing, you know, one of the smartest men in history, we now know he got it wrong. You know, it didn't destroy our minds. But these kinds of debates are natural, this confusion. And it's interesting, the dialogue I talk about called Phaedrus, they wrestle with this question, and it has so many echoes today.
Yeah, Phaedrus is sort of the young, he's almost like the intern figure that has got all the new devices figured out and goes back to his teacher and says, well, this is great, you should check it out.
Yeah, well, he's not a complete enthusiast. I mean, Socrates sort of convinces him to be skeptical about the alphabet. But one of the reasons I tell the story is that they use a written device in the story. They use a scroll to have a really wonderful discussion about a philosophical question. So they're using it to great effect, even though Socrates doesn't seem to recognize that. The other reason I talk about it is they have this conversation out in the country. They take a walk from the busy, hectic world of Athens, where everybody's buzzing around, you know, sort of the ancient equivalent of our lives. Having that scroll with them allows them to have this talk at a distance from their busy lives and really open up a little space between themselves and that craziness. And that's a lesson. You know, the technology can help us disconnect, even though it's a kind of connectedness, if we use it properly.
So then we'll fast forward a little bit, but remain in ancient history here. And you have the Roman senator and philosopher Seneca,
yes,
who grapples with the idea of needing mental space.
Yes. You know, I'm surprised about this. The book's only been out for a couple of weeks, but I'm already realizing that Seneca is really people's favorite. They bring him up all the time, people who've read the book. Seneca was an incredibly, arguably the busiest man in the Roman Empire. For a number of years, he was effectively the emperor because he was the assistant to Nero when Nero was just a boy. And so Seneca took over and basically ran Rome. So nobody could have been busier. But at the same time, he was a philosopher, had been a philosopher, was writing ideas on the side for how to live a good life. And he tried to figure out how to bring this kind of maelstrom of this new connected life in Rome, which was influenced by empire, pulling everyone together more tightly, influenced by written language, which by now had exploded. And what he basically realized was that it's all up to you. It's all inside your own mind, how you're going to manage your life. You have to make your own decisions. And you can set aside spaces and times during the day and or in the evening when you pull back and you're by yourself and you choose one task to do instead of many tasks. And in the piece that I talk about, he does that. He goes into a room where there's a busy street scene happening outside. There's a noisy spa below him where people are lifting weights and grunting. He tunes it all out, and he decides to write a letter to one person, just one person, and focus on that one person. And it allows his mind to go to a new place.
Yeah, there's this idea that I think comes through in many of these examples, which is that we don't spend a lot of time thinking deeply about any one thing these days because there is so much to distract us.
Yeah, you know, Seneca had a great phrase for this. He said that he and his friends and colleagues, sort of the elite people of Rome who were the most busy, the busiest, were suffering from, quote, the restless energy of the hunted mind. Now, I love that phrase because it has two parts. The restless energy is that part where you can't settle down, you know, like your finger's always on the clicker, even when you're not at the screen, which is something I started to feel, you know, in the last decade, where even when I was away from my devices, I couldn't focus on one task. I'd be brushing my teeth and organizing my sock drawer at the same time. And then the hunted mind is that feeling I have, and I know many others have, of your information kind of pursuing you and always weighing on you. What's happening with my inbox? Do I need to check it now? And my message in looking at Rome and these other periods in history is that it's not a new experience. People have been wrestling with this for thousands of years.
Talk for a minute about the way we feel anxiety, at least initially when we disconnect. We may think we need this and crave it and we want to get away from everything, but then there's that fear that something's going on and we're missing out.
Yeah, there's this real feeling of withdrawal and gosh, you know, who am I? You know, I mean, I don't have my digital friends anymore. I don't have that sense of confirmation I get from the screen. My family and I started a ritual some 4 years ago where we disconnect on the weekends. We turn off the household modem. And at the beginning of this ritual, which we call the Internet Sabbath, we were lost. You know, that Saturday morning we'd wake up, we couldn't look at our screens, they were disconnected, and it was really like an existential crisis in the truest sense of the word. It was really an inability to figure out almost how to organize our lives without that tether that we'd had for so long.
And so what you're forced to do, and I shouldn't say forced, but you have to look at each other and talk to each other.
Yeah, so we were driven, in our case, you know, this experiment, which revealed all kinds of useful information to us, we were brought back to the third dimension, to this space we're in together, to the idea of eye contact, to listening to each other patiently, more patiently than we were doing when we were connected digitally 24/7. It's just a different mode of being. It has immense value. It restores what I call depth to life, where you can take an idea or a conversation and go to a place that's more sustained and frankly, more interesting. You can get more out of all your connections, if you're giving them a little more time than we tend to give our tweets and our updates on Facebook. So by disconnecting on a couple days a week, not all the time, we have no interest in running away from our devices, but by bringing some balance, we've found that you restore some of that feeling of sort of selfhood that I think has been slipping away.
William Powers is my guest. He's a former Washington Post staff writer and author of the new book, Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist William Powers. His new book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, a practical philosophy for building a good life in the digital age. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious, Bill, on your internet Sabbaths, when they first began, did you have a hard time justifying this to friends, to colleagues, to people who were accustomed to being able to get your attention during the weekend?
Well, never mind friends and colleagues. We had a hard time justifying it to our 9-year-old son, who had some serious objections. But yes, I mean, not a terribly hard time. Everyone's struggling with this, and I think the typical reaction was a mix of quizzical, curious, and in some cases inspired. You know, people were kind of delighted that somebody was trying a new approach and wanted to see what happened. With work colleagues, you know, we had to do some workarounds. We had to tell people. We're both writers, so we work with editors in New York and other places. And we had to tell people like that that, you know, you're not going to reach us by email on the weekends. You can call us. You know, we still use voice and telephone. So it's kind of a back-to-voice thing on the weekends. Or email us, and we'll get back to you on Monday. And I now get emails all the time today, now years later, that say, I know you won't see this till Monday, but... Which is a nice feeling. People are giving you that space you've asked for, you know, and they're saying, get to this when you can. So in that sense, it's been an education that, in a way, the world is more flexible than I expected it to be. Now, some people couldn't do this. I emphasize in the book, I'm not prescribing this for everybody. You know, there are people who have to have their inbox on the weekends. But I do think the basic idea can be implemented in many lives in different ways. It could be a few hours a day. You know, it could be all kinds of different things. Ours just happened to work best on the traditional weekend.
Now, you mentioned that you still use phones. Reading that in the book, I was sort of interested because for me, I think the phone follows me in a much more plaguing way than my computer, which I can choose to turn on or off as I choose. But now with a smartphone, it's with you all the time and you're getting texts and calls and it's not okay to not be home anymore.
No, I know. We don't have true smartphones, any of us, the three of us, my wife and I and our son. We have, my phone does very primitive email, but I don't have my inbox on there, and I just don't use it for that, really, basically, and none of us do. So we didn't have that challenge of what was on, and we can't browse the web. You know, we can't do internet functions. So we were really basically turning off the true internet, and the phones are only for voice. If we were to get smartphones, we'd have a whole new challenge we'd have to deal with. In fact, I think one of the problems with smartphones is you can't turn off the internet stuff and just go back to voice. As I understand, you have to have them all on at the same time, which I think is too bad because it doesn't allow you to customize.
You do write about an interesting time where your phone basically went overboard when you were sailing. And so for a relatively short time, you were communication free. And interestingly, what you thought about was not sort of all the things your mind could have gone to, but you thought about who you were not connected to at that moment.
Yes. Well, so I was on this boat that I had just bought, and I wasn't a very skilled boater at that point. And I was backing the boat up, and it got tied on someone else's line, and I had to try and fix it. And leaning over the back of the boat, I fell over. My phone was in my pocket. I threw it back in the boat, and it had drowned. It was dead. I got back in the boat. I was really mad at myself and thinking of all the contacts I had to reload and so forth and buy a new phone and all that hassle. But as I drove back across the cove, I found that this wonderful feeling came over me that I was unreachable, that nobody could reach me and I couldn't reach them, and that I hadn't been in that state for a very long time. And it started to feel really good. I started to realize, wait a minute, I remember this from when I was younger. This was a valuable experience. You know, lots of good thinking happens in these moments. Stories that I would have shared instantly, like, for example, the story of falling overboard. Instead of calling my wife and telling her right away the story, it got to kind of gestate in my mind, you know, and maybe take on a little bit of quality that it wouldn't have had if I just called and shared it right away.
Or Facebooked it.
Yeah, or Facebooked it. It's that feeling of, you know, why do we have to share everything instantly and constantly be in touch? What about these moments when you can't be reached? We've all had them. we seem to have abandoned the idea that they're worth anything, but I think they're actually worth a great deal.
What's so alarming about this, and you pointed out here, is that no, we didn't choose to live this way. It sort of just was thrust upon us.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a massive shift in how we live, and yet we never said, let's do this. You know, we never had a meeting. There was never a show of hands. You know, it just kind of happened. And I think that's because we are natural connectors, and it's really rooted in who we are. So it's understandable. But I think you do have to reach a point, and I hope this is that moment in the digital era. You know, we're a couple decades in now, where you do step back and say, is there a smarter way to do this? You know, are we getting the most out of these devices? I think we could actually make better use of them if we use them in a more balanced way. So that's what the conversation I'm trying to start with the book.
We have an email here from Robert who reports, I kept a quote from St. Catherine of Siena on my wall at work. It read, one thing at a time and only one.
Oh, I love that. I wish I'd had that for the book. It's true. You know, humans are not good. We really can't multitask. It's a myth, this idea of multitasking. You can do two things at once, maybe, but even when you're doing two, psychologists have proven this over and over, you don't do them as well as if you were just doing one. Weirdly, you know, we all know this from experience. You learn this when you're a kid. If you're in the classroom and you're trying to write an essay and then, you know, the kid next to you is whispering in your ear, you can't really do both of those things well at once, listen and write. But we keep trying. You know, we keep trying to pretend we're like computers, which are much better at multitasking, but we're not computers. So, you know, I think we should all have that St. Catherine quote on our office walls.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Rob in Fort Worth. Hello, Rob.
Hey, how's it going today?
Great, thank you.
Really enjoy the subject of the conversation. I had a question about the possible impact that the connectivity is actually going to have on our political world, just like Ron Paul just kind of came out of nowhere and got $5 million for his presidential run because a bunch of people were connecting. What kind of effect do you think that'll have in the future of politics? And I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Rob. I think that's not a question I really take on in the book. I don't take on sort of the structural questions of society, and I don't even really go into the whole privacy question with the government and so forth because it's a whole other kettle of fish, and I was trying to focus on, you know, individual happiness, relationships, how we perform at work as people. But I do think, there's no question, that this idea of instant ability to act on something in a field like politics is really changing how politics operates. I mean, it actually opens the door for some scary possibilities if you think about it. If you get a fiery orator who goes on the radio and really gets people to his somewhat dangerous ideas, and I'm not saying this about Ron Paul, I'm just saying generally, sort of the equivalent of what happened in the 20th century when demagogues started to draw people through the radio. The digital medium is an even more powerful way of doing that, of forming these groups overnight. And lots of stuff could happen that wouldn't happen if people had time to think a little bit about the ideas they're adopting.
And another reason that we don't think as much is that we have a really limited tolerance these days for boredom. We fast forward through commercials, and we really can't stand to be not actively engaged in something all the time.
Yeah, this is one of the things that bothers me about my own behavior when I'm on the screen, is that you know, I really just begin to treat everything in life like a commodity, including my relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, if an email is boring me, even though it's from a dear friend, I'm in this mode, this digital mode of thinking where I'll just close it down, even delete it, you know, because it's kind of like I'm on the screen. I'm not here to be bored. I'm trained to keep stimulating myself. I think slowness, you know, slow ways of thinking and reading and pondering has an enormous value in our lives, and we just shouldn't shed that. I found, and I know other people found this too, that beginning about 6 or 7 years ago, I was having trouble staying with a good novel, mm-hmm. which was something I'd always loved to do, read great fiction at night. You know, I would get halfway through a chapter, and I'd have that feeling of it's not coming quick enough. You know, it's not bringing newness to me, and I would put the book aside, and that was a great loss.
Yeah, or you put it aside and you have to go check your email in the middle of it or do something else.
Yeah, and when you do that, you know, if you do that with, I don't care if it's Henry James or someone who's writing today, when you come back to the book, you're not immersed in the way you were when you stayed with, you know, 100 pages at a time. It's a lighter kind of, more superficial kind of immersion. Again, what I say over and over in the book, it's a loss of depth. And that's a big thing to give up.
Well, let's talk about that, because I was fascinated that you included Gutenberg in this list of people, because nobody would argue that he sparked this important technological revolution by allowing books to be mass-produced. But there was an issue with individual readers being isolated in a way they had never been before.
Yes, a lot of people don't know this, but before Gutenberg's era, reading was basically a public activity. Unless you were very wealthy, you couldn't afford to buy books. So most people only experienced books when they went to church and heard other people read them. And the other aspect, they would read them aloud. And the other aspect that's interesting is even when people were alone, because books were an oral activity, they tended to read aloud even when alone. It was considered very strange if you saw someone reading silently by themselves. It hadn't occurred to people that there was any reason to do that. Once Gutenberg made books widely available and cheap, once his technology allowed that to happen in the 15th century, suddenly people got this idea, hey, wait a minute, I can take this book and go off by myself and begin to read silently and have a quiet personal experience. It basically took reading inward. What had been an external experience became inward. And it led to that wonderful journey that we all take when we read a book, which is to a place we've never been to before. We're there by ourselves with the author, and it leads to all kinds of creative thinking in us, irreplaceable. And it all began with Gutenberg.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're talking to William Powers about his new book, Hamlet's Blackberry. Let's go back on the phones now, this time to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hello, Chris. You made a comment about didn't choose to do this in terms of being networked or being connected, and I disagree. I think we choose to do it each time we buy one of these devices, or each time that we choose to switch it on or choose not to switch it off. What we are failing to do is failing to be prepared to take the consequences of not being connected. Some of us are afraid of not being connected, some of us are in the habit of being connected, but the choice is ours and always has been.
That's a really interesting point. What do you think, Bill?
I totally agree with John, actually. I think we are making these choices, but I think we're not making them thoughtfully. I mean, what we didn't choose to do, my point in the book is the thing we didn't choose to do is to embark on a way of life in which we were always connected all the time. We do make these incremental decisions. I'm going to buy an iPad. I'm going to use it for these next 4 hours, and then I'm going to go to the mobile. We do operate in that way. What we don't do is say, what we haven't done is say, I'm going to reshape my life now so I'm never not connected. I don't know anyone who sort of said that. I have a grand new plan. This is how I'm going to live as a digital maximalist. But that's the thing that we did unmindfully, and I think that was our error. I believe it's dawning on people now, and there's a shift that's beginning to happen, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, to your point and to John's, the other thing that it doesn't seem like we chose is to sacrifice time with our loved ones. There's this, you know, scene in the book where you have an entire family, and they're all home, perhaps even in the same room, but no one has any real contact with one another. They're busy tapping away at their separate screens.
Yeah, that family is from a Newsweekly report that I quoted, but really it was reflecting what happened to my family. You know, I call it the vanishing family trick. We had this thing where after dinner we'd be in the living room, supposedly to be together for the evening, you know, to enjoy each other's company, talk, play games. We would peel off one at a time on some flimsy excuse, I have to check something, you know, I need a glass of water. We were all going to our screens, and we wouldn't come back. The family would disappear from the living room, and that's another thing. My wife and I never said to each other, let's spend less time together, let's devote our lives to the screen. But frankly, that's really what was happening, and it was appalling, and that's why we started this this habit of unplugging the modem on the weekends.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up is Stephanie in Dallas. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I love the premise of this, and I announced that I am low-tech, and these are types of things that I participate in just because I simply refuse to participate to this immersed level. But what I have experienced with cell phones is a tremendous breakdown in friendships and relationships because I can't hear them, they can't hear me, calls are dropping, and you just can't have a conversation. You know, I have a very dear friend who's taking care of his father who has Alzheimer's, so I work in medical communications, and, you know, we try to have a conversation, and I don't enjoy sitting there plinking this in as a, you know, manifesto email, but this happens with my brother also. And I know they probably have a microphone swinging in the wind or, you know, some other thing, or talking while they're driving, which is not good. But I, you know, there's no clear voice communication, and it has affected a lot of my relationships.
That's a great point. Even the idea of cell phones, you're pretty sure that the person who's on the other end of that phone isn't devoting their full attention to your conversation.
Yeah. You know, there's this. What, did Stephanie finish? I didn't want to cut off the comment.
I think that was what she had to say.
Okay, yeah. I love the observation because there's this weird assumption almost in the culture. It's almost like a belief that when connectedness is a little bit more broken up and fuzzy, somehow it's cooler and more interesting. I'm thinking of Skype. How, you know, I've Skyped. I'm actually Skyping tomorrow. I have an appointment to do something on Skype. But, you know, in many ways, it's not as good of an exchange as voice in a regular old telephone, even though you can see the person, because you're dealing with this delay and the microphone, as she said, you know, the microphone isn't working and so forth. But there's this sense that because it's new, it doesn't matter that the quality goes down. Because it's new and the latest thing, it's fantastic. And I just don't think that's true. I love the idea that there are people out there still like Stephanie who care about the quality of the exchange, because that's what matters.
Yeah, it's, you wouldn't go to a restaurant or a bar with a friend for a glass of wine and not ask to move if you couldn't hear them where you were sitting.
No, no. And speaking of restaurants, you know, how many times have you had the experience where the person sitting across from you answers their phone and that's the end of your drink together?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's a whole other issue, but it's similar in that aren't we here to have a quality exchange? Why are we doing it through this device where I can't hear you? Or why are we sitting here together at all if you're not going to pay attention to me? It's really sort of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, there's that moment where you're competing with a phone, and they either say, oh, I can let this go, or I have to take this, and you know exactly where you stand.
Yeah, you know, a friend of mine read my book recently and wrote me and said, you know, when I have lunch sometimes with someone and they do that and they abandon me for the cell phone, I think to myself, gee, why don't I go in the ladies' room and call you from the stall? Maybe you'll pay attention to me.
William Powers is my guest. His new book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Washington Post staff writer William Powers. His new book is Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to make sure that we don't leave people hanging as to the title of your book. We all know Hamlet did not actually have a Blackberry, but Shakespeare did put in his hands the sort of must-have device of Jacobean England.
Yes, there was this wonderful device in Shakespeare's time called a table, and it was a little kind of almanac, little booklet that you carried around with you, and you opened it up, and there was one surface inside, a kind of plaster-like surface. During the day, you could write on it with a stylus, not a pen, but a stylus like the ones we have today, and you kept to-do lists, notes, things you wanted to remember from the day. But the beauty of it was, Chris, at the end of the day, it was very easy to wipe clean and start over. So it was a way of imposing some order on your life and really bringing the barrage of information. There was a kind of information explosion during Shakespeare's time because of print, Gutenberg's invention. People felt that they couldn't live without their tables. There are all kinds of quotes from the period. Montaigne, the great French essayist, said he couldn't get through the day without his tables. So Shakespeare gave one to Hamlet, when he meets the ghost for the first time, he says, "My tables, my tables." And he pulls it out and takes some notes about things he wants to remember about the ghost so that he can sort of make sense of that exchange.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to David in Dallas. Hey, David.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Quick comment and a quick question, and I'll take the answer offline. Question, isn't Phaedrus the name of the main character in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and was there a connection between those two? The comment is, I have two kids in college who are making that four-year transition from the world of kids to the world of adults. And when they try to connect and go on interviews and have these internships, I'm constantly stressing the difference between having a business card or somebody as part of your Facebook page and having to have intimacy and connect with people where they actually want to take your call when you follow up. And I don't know if William, you can comment at all on kids as they make this transition and any recommendations you might have.
Great questions. On the first one, David, yes, Phaedrus, the name of the character in the Plato's dialogue, is also the name that Robert Percy gives himself as a character in his own book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which is a very philosophical book that gets into actually ancient Greek as well as Eastern philosophy. I do mention it in my book. I love that book. To the second question about kids and sort of making it in the world by realizing that it's not all just about these media interactions, that we're people who have to interact as human beings. I find that these younger folks today are actually questioning the digital orthodoxy in a way that older people don't, believe it or not. Just in the few weeks my book has been out, I'm finding that younger people are fascinated to think that there is a different way to think about this, and many have been wondering about it themselves and realizing there's more to interacting with others than the screen. And it's as if there's a kind of awakening happening among these people who are, young people are always a little bit more open-minded. So that idea that digital natives want to spend their whole lives in those kind of interactions, I'm beginning to realize it might not be true.
It's almost like there's a glamour to the old way because they haven't lived it before.
Yeah, a 24-year-old said to me recently, you know, my generation is developing this incredible romance with the analog world, the analog era, because we're realizing there were things about that era that we miss, even though we never knew it. I love that thought.
We have an email here from Maria who writes, I've noticed that people don't wait silently anymore, whether they're standing in line at the post office or waiting for someone. We are always checking messages, phones, etc. What are we losing by not being in silence?
Oh, we're losing so much. You know, it's this discounting of the value of quiet and stillness, which all the wisest philosophers, Eastern and Western, throughout history, have always tried to remind people there is so much to be gained in those moments. In those slowing down moments where you're just inside your own consciousness, letting things settle, letting your thoughts go where they will. We meditate, you know, we try to meditate, we go to yoga, but we are treating those things as sort of outside the flow of life, this kind of activity we do that's separate from standing in the post office waiting in line when you can also have a moment of meditation. I think it's important to work that sensibility back into as much of our lives as we can.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. This time we'll speak with Matt in Rockwall. Hello, Matt.
Hello. I'm a truck driver, so I've got a whole lot of time where I have nothing to do but think. And my wife says that always comes to nothing but good. And I mean, it comes to nothing good. And you've given me an idea that she's just going to hate. My family right now is a lot like yours was. After dinner, actually, we pretty much eat dinner at our computers or in front of the TV. We'll all be in the same room. My wife will be on her computer watching something on Hulu. I watch TV on IMDb sitting at the computer. One boy will be on the Xbox. The other one will be on his computer playing the game. And we'll be there for 3-4 hours during the night, but we're all sitting there with our backs to each other.
Yeah.
So we're there, but we're not together. So the suggestion that she's really going to fight me on, and I know my boys are, is even though I drive a truck, I am home on weekends, we're going to start engaging in one day of technological abstinence.
Oh, I love it.
My boys don't even go outside right now because they've got something they can do inside. So they're going to learn to play the way I did as a kid. Go outside and use your imagination.
Any ideas, Bill, for how he can convince the family that this will not be the end of their entire lives?
Yeah, I have a couple of ideas. One is that tell them ahead of time that in the beginning there's going to be a transition period that's difficult so that they're prepared. Because there's this, as I said, there's this withdrawal period that's very rocky. But when you get on the other side of it, it takes, for in our case, it took a couple months of doing this once a week. Everything opens up, and everyone, even my 9-year-old, sees the light and begins to realize, wow, I am gaining a lot by this. The second thing I would say is you can do something in your house that I call in the book creating a Walden zone, inspired by Henry David Thoreau's cabin at Walden Pond. You can create a space in your house, where a room, where you can't have your backs to each other at your screens because there are no screens in that room. You can just have a basket at the door where people have to leave their mobiles, no computers in that room. And it can be a place where, having watched Hulu, something on Hulu, and enjoyed it, which my family loves to do, you go and talk about it in this other space. You know, I love the idea of a space set aside for this, not just a time of day, which I think is great that you're doing it and we do that, but also a place to go that's less connected.
It's pretty amazing if you think back I think back to my childhood in the 70s and 80s, and everybody was worried about, you know, watching TV. But at least with television, people were consuming the same media at the same time.
Yeah, there's something about the passivity, the shared passivity of television. You know, passivity of television was always considered its great downside. But there is something about that experience of sitting together watching the same thing, and where you can't reach out and respond, and it can't reach out to you as an individual. You're just watching, enjoying. That is a nice kind of togetherness. I mean, maybe I'm just a hopeless product of the television age, but we still love television, and we actually still watch it on the weekends. We just make sure that it's a family activity, that we don't just go off by ourselves with the TV.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Natifa in Flower Mound. Hi, Natifa.
Hi. I'm enjoying this show very much, and I want to make some points really, really quick. He said a whole lot of what I have to say. I'm probably just going to use a little bit different terminology. I think that, number one, we are naturally social beings with an intuitive tribal craving, and I think that's at the core of all of our beings. And I think that we are trying to interrupt that with this new technology, and I don't think we're going to succeed in the long run. We are giving 5-year-olds cell phones. They're being reeled in cell phones, and they have not had the opportunity to learn natural communication skills, which I think is going to inhibit their relationships in the future. And I believe that we will have higher divorce rates because of this emptiness that we are projecting and enlarging. We will have fewer true friendships, because it's more likely that we will be dishonest when we're talking to somebody via a technology device, as opposed to, say, we ask you a spontaneous question on the phone and you don't have an opportunity to contrive an immediate response.
Those are really interesting points. What do you think, Bill?
I really love those points. Thank you, Natifa. I think my one slice of it that's a little bit different would be, I think all those threats are real, and we are facing them as a possibility. But I do think, based on my review of history that I did, that I share in the book, I think human beings are very good at actually recognizing when they're going down a bad road with technology and changing direction. I saw it over and over in the moments I looked at, where there was a kind of a silliness in how people, you know, first reacted to the technology. They went overboard, much as we are. And then they figure that out, and they realize, hey, wait a minute, I'm losing more than I'm gaining here. You know, I am in life to have good relationships. Let me fix this. And so I think it's about tinkering, because we're aware. I mean, we're having this conversation on the radio now. I think we're starting to figure it out, and that in the long run, we are going to change our ways.
Well, to take it back to the great Marshall McLuhan, he was convinced that the best tool for fighting back at screens would always be the mind itself.
Yes. You know, McLuhan is often confused. You know, the medium is the message. It sounds like he's some big geek who just thinks computers should be running the world. Mm-hmm. Exact opposite. He felt we should be running the world, we should be running our lives, and the ultimate device for doing that is the human mind. No matter how powerful the barrage of information, he called it the maelstrom, that we're immersed in with new information, we can take control. It starts with belief. You have to know, you have to believe that you want to change, and everything takes off from there.
Yeah, you remind us here that blaming the technology rather than ourselves sort of misses the point. It's like expecting the chocolate cake to help us with our overeating.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that the technologies could be improved. I think there's a bias now in the technologies to kind of keep making us busy, you know, so we can have our screens full of all these pages and distractions and pop-ups. That's not good. But I think in the end, it really is about us. And what one of the earlier callers said, you know, we do make a decision. Every time we go to a screen or buy a new device, we're deciding that. And so I think it begins inside our own minds. The very last line of the book, I say, you know, tap your temple twice. It's all in there. I think that's where the answer is. And that's, I think that thought is empowering. You know, we are in charge. That's what McLuhan said. That's essentially what all these philosophers say. And I found reading them very inspiring, which is why I shared their stories in the book.
We have time very quickly for one final call from Jeff in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I've been listening over the years, and I'm very concerned with the information revolution because we have a tendency to start adopting a vocabulary that's not within our own creative, I guess, process. And we are not remaining in control of our, well, destiny anymore. We get fed information through the television. We get fed information through the radio, through the net. And it's pretty soon we're living another alternate reality, which isn't our own choosing. And I don't know if I'm saying all this correctly, because I'm going to go ahead and hang up at this point because I could go on and take it from there. I have a long way of saying things.
So. Well, thanks very much for your call.
But I'm going to get this book. I appreciate I like your way of thinking, and I'm going to buy your book.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Jeff. I would say that I see the threat that Jeff is talking about and this worry that we're being led around on a leash by technology, and I think that is happening now, which is why I wrote the book. But I also think we have to remember that these technologies have fantastic potential for individualism. You know, the idea that we live in a blog, in a world in which everyone can have a blog and everyone can have a voice, the possibilities there for autonomy and self-expression and being your own person are wonderful. But I believe it only is going to happen if you learn how to achieve some balance. If you're always surrounded by what I call the digital crowd, always in that world of digital technology and interaction, you give up so much autonomy that you're never going to get to that good place.
So, Bill, how do your Internet Sabbath weekends change the way you feel about the rest of the week?
Oh, it's fantastic. I don't think I said this earlier. The benefits of the weekend flow over into our connected time. So that when we come back to our screens on Monday, we have a whole new attitude. You know, it's like when you take a walk or a swim or, for that matter, a couple weeks off from your job. You know how you come back and you're sort of a new person?
Mm-hmm.
That happens to us now every Monday after we've been offline for 2 days. It's like we're renewed. We have a new perspective on our digital life. We don't feel sort of cornered by it, and that feeling of like the burden of the inbox weighing on you, even though we have those emails waiting from us for the weekend, because we've been away, we just have a fresher way of looking at it, and it's wonderful. It's just that idea, again, like my mantra, balance is what it's all about.
William Powers' new book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Bill, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks so much, Chris. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.